For Pacifica Radio, March 23rd, 2014. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. All right, y'all, welcome to the show. It is Anti-War Radio. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Scott Horton here every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. My own website is scotthorton.org. You can find my full interview archive there, more than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And you can follow me on Twitter if you want, at Scott Horton Show. And so today will be part 7 of the interview series begun on the show last week and continuing all through the week on my other radio show with the great independent journalist Dr. Gareth Porter, author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks very much, Scott. Thanks for having me back.
Very good to have you here. And if anybody wants to catch up on this series, they're all there already in MP3 format for you there in the archive at scotthorton.org. All right, so this is part 7 of our interview series about Manufactured Crisis. On Chapter 8, The Mystery of the Laptop Documents. And so, again, the book is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And we've covered a lot of the IAEA investigations into what all the Iranians are doing. And it looked like right at the end of 2007, they got pretty much a clean bill of health. But then again, the alleged studies documents were brought up. Purporting to show Iranian progress on a nuclear weapons program, a secret nuclear weapons program. They're known as the alleged studies documents, the smoking laptop, the possible military dimensions, and even the laptop of death. And it's about 1,000 pages of documents that were handed over to the CIA in the fall of 2004. And, well, Gareth, where did these laptop documents come from?
Well, of course, the myth, first of all, let's just talk about what the myth of their origins is and was, and that is that the documents were supposedly coming from within this covert Iranian nuclear weapons program from 2001 to 2003. And there was a whole set of stories that were spun around that idea. One of which was told by somebody who had been in the Bush administration or who had been in the intelligence community and was supposedly retired, who told David Sanger that the documents had been on the laptop of this engineer who had been participant. He didn't say engineer, but a participant in this covert nuclear weapons research project in Iran, and that the person who had these documents on his computer was apparently somehow or other out of sympathy with the policy and was intending to turn these over to people outside the country. And he was afraid at one point that he'd been discovered or that he was suspected of doing some sort of spying. And he managed to get the documents out through his wife. Out of the country. And so that was one of the stories. And then, you know.
Well, and then he died mysteriously or was supposedly killed by the regime?
Well, I was going to say that, that part of that, related to that, is this notion that the U.S. government was never clear on whether this person was still alive or not. Hmm. And indeed, Mohammed El-Baradei, the director general of the IAEA during this period, when the documents materialized, says in his memoirs that he was told by the Americans that they were not sure if this person was still alive or had died. So that was clearly part of this what I call a cover story about the documents. There were other cover stories as well, which I won't get into. But
and the other cover stories are completely contradictory to that one, right?
Well, I mean, they're not. They're different from, but they're along the same lines that, you know, one of them was that the guy was a spy for the Germans, that the German intelligence agency, the BND, had recruited a spy, an Iranian who was a businessman, and that's how they got the document.
Mm-hmm. Which is still a lot different
It is different.
Yeah, still much different than it was a scientist, and we don't know what happened to him, but his wife got it out for us.
That's
a pretty specific story. That either holds or it doesn't, right?
That's a very specific story, and you know, it's not really very credible for a whole bunch of reasons, mostly that, you know, if he was believing that he was under surveillance, the idea that his wife would waltz out of the country with a laptop full of these documents it just doesn't pass the laugh test at all, mm-hmm. clearly.
And then you say in the chapter that early on in the story, the CIA had admitted that they didn't really know where the documents came from and that they even suspected that they had come from the Mujahideen e-Khalq. Is that correct?
Well, that's what I wrote, and indeed that was what the Washington Post reported later on. And what this underlines, just very quickly to take care of that point, is that there were some people, analysts within the CIA and elsewhere in the U.S. intelligence community, who were not part of the deal. I mean, they weren't insiders in the Bush administration, and so they were not apprised of what the official line was supposed to be, or you know, that there was a line here that was being protected. And those are the people, I'm sure, who are being quoted there by the Washington Post. But, you know, the people who were the insiders, the neoconservatives in the Bush administration, and I assume that when Porter Goss became CIA director, he was CIA director when these documents were acquired by the CIA. He was clearly part of the what I think it's fair to say is a plot to keep the truth from not just the American people, but from other people in the administration, including Colin Powell, Secretary of State, at that point, because Powell didn't really know. Wasn't really told the truth of what happened. He was given the idea that I've just told you, the official line. Mm-hmm. So that is the official line. But I'm able to pretty much document without any question that what really happened, the way those documents really came into the possession of Western intelligence, is that they were handed over by a member of the Mujahideen e-Khalq.
All right, now stop right there, because I want to hear all that evidence, best you can assemble it for us here.
Yeah.
But first, you got to tell us, what's a Mujahideen e-Khalq?
Yes, Mujahideen e-Khalq is the terrorist organization which had started as a kind of blend of Muslim and Marxist revolutionaries against the Shah. Initially, as soon as the Shah was overthrown, they were supporting the new government, but they quickly came to a very sharp conflict with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Very soon, by the early 1980s, they were carrying out terrorist bombings against government organized meetings. And indeed, Ali Khamenei apparently suffered the loss of the use of one of his arms because of a terrorist bomb set by the MEK in one of those meetings. That is the supreme leader of Iran, the present supreme leader. So there's no question about their terrorism in Iran. But before that, they carried out assassinations of U.S. military and civilians in Iran before the Shah was overthrown. And of course, they were then they moved to Iraq from Iran when they came to blows with the regime in Tehran, and then they became the tools of Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and they were used by Saddam for various kinds of operations against Iran during the Iran-Iraq War.
And then George Bush invaded Iraq in 2003.
Yeah, Bush invaded Iraq. The neoconservatives wanted then to come to a kind of peace agreement with the MEK so that they could be useful for the future to try to destabilize Iran. Colin Powell and other people in the State Department weren't buying that, and the policy was never officially adopted. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of there was a face-off within the Bush administration about what to do about the MEK.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we talked about in one of these previous interviews, when we spoke about cooperation between the Iranians and the Americans after September 11th, it was part of an ongoing negotiation, but it was also part of their golden offer of 2003, that they would just love to turn over some captured al-Qaeda guys in exchange for Mujahideen-e-Khalq. And the Americans preferred to let the Iranians hold on to the al-Qaeda guys so that they could keep the MEK and use them for their own purposes.
Well, to be more specific, of course, what you really mean is that the neoconservatives were pushing very hard to make no deal whatsoever with Iran, and that meant that they did not want any cooperation on al-Qaeda or anything else, including, you know, of course, exchanging intelligence about al-Qaeda. And so they very deliberately turned down an opportunity to get some very valuable intelligence simply because it was in conflict with their regime change objective. Mm-hmm.
All right. And then so now tell us what all we know for a fact about the MEK's involvement with the Israeli Mossad.
Well, the MEK had already had developed a close working relationship with Mossad in the 1990s. This has been documented in the New Yorker piece by Connie Bruck, who actually amazingly got an Israeli diplomat in Washington on the not on the record, it wouldn't be quoted, but off the record, saying that, yes, we did, in fact, support the MEK. We gave them various kinds of aid, for example, supporting their broadcasting capabilities, building up broadcasting capabilities for the MEK. And he said, we found them very useful. But he wouldn't comment further than that.
All right. Well, but you know more about them than that, right?
Well, I mean, of course, there was a very important relationship or usefulness of MEK that is important in this storyline, and that is that in 2002, the MEK went public in a press conference in Washington, D.C., revealing the existence of the Natanz uranium enrichment facility. Two points about that, though, which are not generally understood, not generally known.
Let me add one thing here about the MEK for people that they might remember from current reference, is that 2 years ago, the administration put a story in NBC News, spring of 2012, saying that the Israelis were using the MEK to assassinate Iranian scientists and that it was messing up American diplomacy and they didn't appreciate it. That was a pretty big deal, and especially because it was very clear that it came from the very top. It was not some kind of mid-level whistleblower or something. This was a very official leak to NBC.
It was a big story, and it certainly is credible that the MEK could have been used for that purpose. So that is indeed another part of this relationship, at least as far as the evidence that has been put out by the Obama administration, which is a pretty important source.
Right. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just thought that would help with the context here about who is this group of Mujahideen, basically hired guns who keep going from master to master around the Middle East.
Right. And the point that I wanted to make is that the MEK, of course, claims that they have all these inside people in the defense and nuclear institutions in Iran who feed them information. They're sympathizers or people who really believe in the same thing as the MEK who are feeding them information. And in this case, it's clear that they didn't have any such inside information at all because they got the function of this facility wrong. They called it a fuel fabrication plant. Mm-hmm. Fuel fabrication facility.
You're talking about when they identified the Natanz facility?
Pardon?
You're talking about when they identified Natanz in 2002?
Yeah, when they identified Natanz. They called it a fuel fabrication facility instead of a uranium enrichment facility. And that is a fundamental mistake that you could only make if you were, an outsider just guessing, which is what was really going on. And, of course, they gave the dimensions and the map coordinates of Natanz, and they didn't have the capability themselves to get that information. They had to get that from the Israelis, and it's been reported both by Cy Hirsch quoting an IAEA, an unnamed IAEA official, and by another source that the Israelis did indeed pass that information on to the MEK. So we know that, in fact, the MEK has served the purpose of passing on intelligence information or purported intelligence information that the Israelis did not want to have associated with them because it would have been less credible.
Right.
And so that's the key point, I think, that I wanted to make about the MEK and its role in the nuclear issue.
Okay, yeah. So now, I mean, the fact that something came from the Israelis doesn't necessarily mean that it's inaccurate, although I think we need to get back to that because you need to explain how it was that you know.
Right.
I think understating it, that this collection of alleged studies documents did in fact come into Western intelligence streams by way of the MEK.
Yes, and the reason we know that is that a senior Foreign Office, former Foreign Office official named Karsten Voigt, who had been the spokesperson in foreign policy for the SPD, the Socialist Democratic Social Democratic Party of Germany, before he was named to the Foreign Office position, had been the coordinator for German North American relations for several years by 2004, and remained in that position, by the way, until he retired in 2010. And I had an interview with him on the record a year ago now. It was March of 2013, in which he told really the full story behind the acquisition of the so-called laptop documents by German intelligence. And he said it happened because a member of the MEK brought them in and gave them to the BND, the German Foreign Intelligence Agency. And this MEK member had been an occasional source for BND in the past. The problem was that they did not regard this source as very credible. They did not think that they could trust this source to bring them accurate information. The term that Karsten Voigt used in the interview with me was that they considered the source doubtful. And of course, this suggests that they were doubtful about the use of these documents to make policy. And indeed, Voigt made it clear to me that the body language and everything about the conversation that he had with senior members of the BND, the German Foreign Intelligence Agency, was that they wanted him to warn the Americans, don't use these documents to make policy. And the context here, very important context, is that Colin Powell had just made a public statement in mid-November 2004 when this conversation, just before this conversation had taken place, in which he had talked about information that the United States intelligence had obtained that showed that Iran was working very hard to combine their ballistic missile with a weapon. And by that, everybody understood he meant a nuclear weapon. So the German intelligence officials were very concerned because it looked to them like the United States was trying to make a case that Iran was indeed working on nuclear weapons, that it had a nuclear weapons program. And of course, the background of this is all about Curveball, because Curveball, the Iraqi source who had told these tales about bioweapons labs in Saddam's Iraq, had been a source for the BND. He had told his tales to BND officials. And they had passed it on, of course, to the CIA. But they ultimately realized, after they talked to him enough, that the guy couldn't be telling the truth. They just didn't believe him anymore. And so in December 2002, the head of the BND, August Hanning, warned the then head of the CIA, George Tenet, not to rely on these documents. Don't rely on these documents without further corroboration, he said in a personal note to Tenet. But, of course, we know that Tenet paid no attention to him. Then Colin Powell used the same information from Curveball to make the case for war with Iraq at the United Nations. So here's Colin Powell again using a source that they found doubtful to make a case that sounded suspiciously like it was the beginning of yet another case for war against another Middle Eastern country.
And then you also have a second German source corroborating the origin of the documents here. Is that correct?
Well, that's what's interesting. I mean, Karsten, I knew to get in touch with Karsten Voigt because there had been two previous instances where he and another German source had said something to the effect that these documents did in fact come from the MEK. And the first time was when Voigt himself made a public statement through the Wall Street Journal a few days after the conversation that he described to me with BND. And in that interview with Wall Street Journal, he said, almost word for word, the United States and Europe should not make policy on the basis of single-source headlines. And he said the information that Powell had referred to in his remarks to the press came from a dissident Iranian group. That was the term he used. And then, you know, a few years later, in late 2007, I had the opportunity to speak with a second German source who was close to the foreign minister of Germany, who said to me, I can assure you that these documents came from the Iranian resistance organization, meaning the MEK. There's only one resistance, you know, armed resistance organization, and that's the MEK.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, we've got less than 10 minutes, but I think we can do it. We've got to cover the red flags in these documents.
Yes.
And then your reasons that you conclude it's a circumstantial case, but I think a powerful one, Gareth, that the Israeli Mossad forged these documents and then funneled them through the MEK into the American intelligence stream.
Well, it's really interesting that there are so many things about these documents that raised red flags for people who were intelligence analysts who had a chance to look at them. Of course, I've never seen the documents. They've never been released. There's never even been anything more than like brief paragraphs written about them by the IAEA in their reports. But the interesting thing is how David Albright, who we now know as a very strong supporter of the line that Iran cannot be trusted because it has a record of a proven record of having had a covert nuclear weapons program. In 2008, when I interviewed him about the documents, he was very forthright in saying that there were the people that he talked to who'd read them couldn't really figure out, make sense of them, because there were so many things that didn't add up. They just didn't make sense. One of them was that there was nothing in the papers about design of nuclear weapons. How can there be a covert nuclear weapons research program without some element of it that is devoted to designing nuclear weapons? But there was nothing there. And of course, I mean, you know, you'd expect to see various things about testing of various kinds. I mean, you know, they would have to have, you know, be working on you know, the mechanisms, the technology that would be needed for testing the parts and the whole. And there's no sign of that either. The main problem that he brought up was that it just didn't hang together. It didn't seem like this sounded like a reasonable profile of a nuclear weapons program or a nuclear weapons research project. Then the second thing that he highlighted was that the work that had been done on the one part of this alleged program that was the most spectacular, most sensational in terms of news coverage, that was the supposed program or effort to redesign the reentry vehicle of the Shahab 3 ballistic missile so that it could take it could integrate what appeared to be a nuclear weapon. And he said, you know, I can't figure out. And he said he had asked the New York Times why they didn't write anything about this. The work that was done on those drawings, on the computer simulations, or the computer modeling, I should say, was so poor. He called it primitive. He said, why is it so primitive? And apparently this had been something that the people who had read the documents were puzzled by that it was so poorly done.
All right, now I'm sorry, I got to interrupt and fast forward through here.
Yeah.
There are also major technical flaws, you say, in the uranium flowchart documents, and then as you were mentioning there in the warhead design.
Yep.
And there's then the question of the mine and whether it was a military operation or not, and that is part of your answer to the last question here, is about the evidence that these are actual forgeries. They couldn't possibly be real. They must be forgeries, and they must have come from Israel, to wrap
yeah.
that up.
So I mean, the first point that I find to be a dead giveaway that these documents were fabricated by the Israelis is that the reentry vehicle that is shown in the drawings that, again, were the ones that were the most given the most play by the United States, it was the wrong reentry vehicle. It was a reentry vehicle of the Shahab 3, the original version, which I show in the book was abandoned by the Iranians, the Iranian Defense Ministry, as early as 2000. They started redesigning that, having an entirely new version of the ballistic missile that would have greater range and be more. It would pass the flight test, which the Shahab 3 did not do. In three flight tests, it was not successful. So they had a completely different reentry vehicle that didn't resemble the one on the Shahab 3 at all, and that was that's a fundamental giveaway. I mean, there's no way that they would have done this kind of computer modeling of a missile that they'd already given up on. So this was a giveaway that the people who did the documents simply were not aware of the shift, the changeover. And that was the first giveaway. The second one was that there was a, how to put this in the briefest way possible, there was a Project 5, which was supposed to be uranium conversion, mining conversion, and enrichment. And one of the sub-projects was supposed to be Project 5.15, and it turns out that Project 5.15 was actually started by the Iranian Civilian Atomic Energy Organization 2 years before the beginning of this alleged national secret nuclear weapons project of Iran. So that was the second giveaway. And Ali Heinonen, who I confronted about this, admitted ultimately that he didn't have any answer for the contradiction that I'd pointed out. Ali Heinonen being the former head of the Safeguards Department of the IAEA, who really pushed these documents to the full when he was there.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Yeah, and then you also say here that based on these documents, the IAEA tried to expand their inspections to all of Iran's missile facilities, as they had to acquit themselves, burden of proof on them to show that these bogus documents weren't right, and that was where they balked. And then that became, and set me straight on the date here, that became the brand new excuse to pretend that the Iranians weren't cooperating. Oh, look, they don't want to open up all their missile facilities for us.
Yeah, I mean, there was what I call a trap that Ali Heinonen set for the Iranians. He wanted to goad them into taking the position that they would refuse to cooperate with the IAEA's investigation of these papers. So what he did was, he went further than what you suggested, Scott. He actually did not just want the right to visit various facilities working on defense things. He actually demanded that the Iranians turn over the blueprints, in effect, of the Shahab 3, one of the top military secrets of Iran, and was saying that unless they did that, they weren't going to be regarded as cooperating with the investigation. And of course, the Iranians said, no, we're not going to do that. And they actually cut off their conversations with the IAEA over that issue in September of, or August, I guess it was, of 2008.
Okay, and I'm sorry, but we are all out of time. We got to go. That is the great Gareth Porter, everybody. The book is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And I'm Scott Horton. This has been Anti-War Radio for this morning. We're back here every Sunday from 8:30 to 9 here on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. You can find all of my interviews, including this whole series with Gareth Porter, at scotthorton.org. Thanks very much. See you next week.